Hey everyone, welcome back to Citywide Blackout, your home for music, movies, and more. I'm your host, Max Bowen. Although they never met, writer Robin Clifford Wood felt a powerful connection with Rachel Field, so much so that she decided to write The Field House, the first ever biography on this National Book Award-winning novelist. In this interview, Robin talks about the research process and the many people who helped, including members of Field's family. We look at what is included in the book, and how she knew when to stop writing and seek out a publisher. And joining me now, she is the author of the new book, The Field House, released on May 4th through She Writes Press. Author Robin Clifford Wood joins me. Robin, welcome to the show. It's great to have you here.
It's great to be here, Max. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. So let's start off by talking about sort of the origins of this book. This book is more or less a biography and memoir of writer Rachel Field. Now, I don't know who that is, totally new to the name. Tell me about Rachel, about why you want to write about her.
Okay. Well, Rachel Field, in her day, which was she was born in 1894, and her peak of her writing career was in the 20s and 30s and into the early 40s, but she died quite suddenly and prematurely in 1942 at age 47. But she had made an incredible name for herself. She wrote about 32 books, if you include all that. She wrote a lot of children's books. She was the first woman to win the Newbery Award, which is the a big national award for children's books. But then she always aspired to write novels for the big leagues. And her first novel won the National Book Award. And then one of her later books called All This and Heaven Too was made into a blockbuster Hollywood film, which starred Betty Davis and Charles Boyer and was nominated for Best Picture. And she moved to Hollywood, and that's where she was living at the end of her life. She did some writing for Disney and was on a short list considered for to be the screenplay writer for Gone with the Wind. And I mean, she was a really big deal. And my husband and I moved into her old summer house on an island off the coast of Maine in 1994. It had been empty for about eight years. And I became intrigued with this writer. And I started to wonder, how come no one's ever written about her life? There was a big splash right after she died, but then she seemed to fade, and I didn't know why. And the more I learned about her, the more I became completely enchanted by her life and her writing. And I thought I would see if I could bring her light back to the world.
Okay. Do you find that the two of you connect in terms of your writing styles?
Absolutely. It's very interesting you asked that question, because my mother, who's no longer living, but this project started 13 years ago, so it's been a long labor of love. And my mother did live long enough to read the first several chapters. And when she read those, she said, "Gosh, Robin, your writing reminds me of Rachel Field's writing," because she had also been reading Rachel Field's stuff because of my interest. And my husband also read a bunch of her poetry, which is my favorite of Rachel Field's work. He said, "Robin, her poetry sounds a lot like yours." I liked writing rhyming verse, and Rachel wrote a lot of rhyming verse. So I did resonate with her in a lot of ways. Some was probably preceded my getting to know her, and then I might have emulated her as I read more of her stuff. So,
could you give some examples as to how the two of you connect in terms of writing?
In terms of writing, I'd say we both have a reverence for childhood and for the natural world. A shared love of this tiny little island off the coast of Maine that has no roads. It's all footpaths. You arrive on the ferry and cart your stuff in a wheelbarrow a mile across the island to your house. And it's very remote, and just living in such intimacy with the rhythm of the tides and seabirds' calls and the thick moss in the woods and the quiet of it. Those are all things that I love to write about, and Rachel did too. So in terms of our writing, that I guess we share that. I think we probably share more in terms of you know, character and life. And that was revealed as I did my research on her life.
How did you research? Because as I understand it, this is the first biography about her life and work. So how did you find out about her?
Well, as I say, right after she died, there was quite a splash about it. The Hornbook magazine, which is still around, had a whole feature dedicated to Rachel Field. There were commemorative things written about her. There have been people have written academic papers about her that I could find that were published, but there was nothing, no full length biography. One of her great friends, named Ruth Stanley Brown, happened to be President Garfield's granddaughter. I traced her writing of Rachel Field's biography across a span of several years, because I found all of Ruth's papers are in the Library of Congress in D.C., which is one great cache of information I found. And she wrote the entire biography of Rachel's life. It tracked her through childhood. She said, I'm writing the Radcliffe years, because she attended Radcliffe College in 1914 to 18. And then she said, now I'm writing the California years, and now I'm almost done. And she sold it to Rand McNally, and they were going to publish it, and suddenly it just disappeared, no trace. And I never found out for sure what happened to it, but there was a terrible tragedy in Rachel's family at that point, and her death itself was so tragic. I have a feeling that her surviving husband, just who was very private in the first place, he had to be wheedled into allowing stuff to be written about her or her family much. And I think at that point he just said, she just shut it down. So that's my theory anyway.
Did you find anything about her life in doing your research that like genuinely surprised you, things you had no idea about?
Yeah, there were several things like that. I think the fact that she couldn't read until she was 10 years old. She literally could write before she could read. She could make the letter characters onto a page, but she could memorize. She listened to reading, and her mother read aloud to her. Her teachers read aloud to her, and that was her preference. So that was sort of an interesting thing. One of the other big surprises was that she had some of her poetry. Her later poetry has really intense heartbreak in it, and I had no clue what love interest had provoked this serious heartbreak, and I spent years trying to figure out who that was. She didn't marry till she was 40, and I did find out stuff about her husband, who was Arthur Peterson, but nothing in that relationship indicated there was ever any kind of, you know, tumultuous, passionate heartbreak. And that appears in her poems. So that was like a great mystery that I did finally solve. But it would be a spoiler if I told you too much more about that. So I'll leave that up in the air.
Exactly. Exactly. You've got to buy the book if you want to know the story, folks. Now, you mentioned earlier that you actually live in her house. What was it like living there? Did you feel sort of a connection to her by being in the same rooms that she was in?
Absolutely. So as I say, this island has no roads. So moving stuff on and off the island is very cumbersome. So generally, when people sell a house on Sutton Island, they sell it with all its contents. And not only that, I think Rachel had gone to California, and this is a summer place. She went usually in May or June, and she stayed until October. She went about four months a year. She lived in this house on the island. But still, I think once she moved, she didn't know for sure that she was not coming back until California life absorbed her. And so there is mail of hers in the attic. There are magazines with her name on it. There's galley proofs to one of her books of poetry in a drawer. There's a map of The City of Paris from 1920. And from her letters, I know that she traveled to Paris that summer of 1920. So I know that was hers. She writes about the key to the house. It has a little illustration of it. And I know we used that very key when we first lived there. So I know she sat on these same old wicker chairs. I know she used the same old giant ceramic mixing bowl in the kitchen. So, I mean, it's, you really feel like you're living in a historic home amidst the spirit of the past. And I felt that really from the moment we first walked into the place.
I kind of like the idea about living on a small island like that. Given that this is someone that you definitely have a connection with, not only as a writer, through your own family, through living in her house, did this make the whole process more personal for you?
It became more and more personal for me as time went along, Max. I suppose one of the biggest surprises of this process, there was this moment when I was probably maybe 5 or 6 years into the project. And I went into a MFA program for creative writing, the Stone Coast program through the University of Southern Maine. It's a fabulous low residency program. And one of my faculty members, I said to her, I kept on trying to put this project away because I thought I'm never going to finish. There's so many unanswered mysteries. I just forget it, and I try to put it away, and then I'd get a call from an archive librarian. Oh, someone wants me to share their Rachel Field material with you. And can I give them your name? Or someone calls me, and I kind of became the Rachel Field expert. So people would call, how do I find out copyright information about this poem? Or someone called and said, can you read Rachel Field's poetry on top of Cadillac Mountain for this statewide event? So she sort of, the project kept diving back in front of me. And there were all these odd coincidences. I had, I was more of a full-time mother than anything else for 25 years. But writing was always this thing in the wings, wanting my attention. And I slowly kept, creeping along through this project. But I feel like Rachel Field almost, guided me through to getting serious about my writing and about writing her book. So the thing I was going to get to is as these things kept coming at me, I said to this teacher at Stone Coast, why can't I get rid of this story? Why can't I shed this book? I just keep coming back to it. And she looked at me as though she's like, no, duh. And she said, because you love her. And I almost laughed. And I thought, that's ridiculous. And then I thought, oh, my gosh. I think maybe that's right. And it had never crossed my mind. But, when you read, I read her writings from when she was 13 years old. I read her poetry throughout her life. I read her most intimate love letters. I read her insecurities. I read letters from her to her mom and many letters written by her friends who she had more people who adored her. She made such a impact on so many people she touched. And so I hadn't really realized how immersed I'd become in her life. And she did become extremely important to me.
Now, in writing this biography, you obviously want to get all the details right. And it sounds like you were getting like little pieces of the story here and there. How did you know when you were done, when you were saying, okay, no more research, no more waiting for more snippets, we're going to publish this thing?
I was dependent on another writer to find that out. Along the way, this is a guy actually who called the Schlesinger Library at Radcliffe to say, I want to donate my Rachel Field collection. And they're the ones who called me and said, hey, can I give this guy your name? And that guy's name is Benson Bobrick, and he's written several biographies. He's a writer in Vermont. And we connected, and he was so excited that someone was writing Rachel Field's biography. He had considered writing it himself because one of Rachel Field's very best friends and her lawyer, who took care of her estate and everything, was Benson Bobrick's godmother. His godmother, Marion Severn, had passed on all of her Rachel Field stuff to him. And so we connected over Rachel Field. He invited me to his home and shared his private collection with me before he donated it. And And he also became a mentor for me in terms of the writing. And I asked him at one point along the way, it seemed like I loved the research. I could have researched forever. It's like a treasure hunt. And I asked him along the way, how do I know when I'm done with the research? And his response was, you're never done. You just have to start writing. And so that was really, really helpful to me because it did push me to just start getting it all down on paper and not worry about any gaps that might be there. Either I'll fill them in or I won't. But I think that the book came together.
Okay. Let's look at the writing process. Now, I know that you are not new to writing. You have worked as a columnist for many, many years. You've taught college writing, but I believe this is actually your first book. What were some of the bigger challenges for you when the time came to stop researching and start writing?
I think organization is a big challenge. That's not one of my strengths. So I tried different computer programs that people suggested to me. And in the end, it was really just Microsoft Word is quite sophisticated and allowed me to. But I have thousands of pages of notes and overlapping files and photographs. One of the worst things was that all my photographs, I photographed all the documents in all the archive libraries I visited from, you know, California, Washington, D.C., Boston, Connecticut, all over the place, Louisiana. Someone has told me since then, there's a way to photograph documents to turn them into PDFs that you can search. But I didn't know that at the time. So every document is just a photograph. So going through my documents was a really tedious process. So it was, it was a little trial and error, and it took a long time. But, it was piece by piece.
Now, how do you organize the information?
Benson Bobrick helped me with. He said, start by writing chronologically. And you might mess around with the timeline later on. But that was another helpful thing. It just sort of takes you out of that paralysis mode and just gets you to get going and get it down on paper. I think in the end, I ended up doing some backtracking here and there because, I'm writing about her big writing triumphs, like winning the Newbery, but then I have to backtrack to talk about some stuff in her personal life. There's a little bit of backtracking from chapter to chapter, but for the most part, it goes chronologically.
I know that when it comes to writing a book, part of it is marketing. You want to write something that is going to sell. Did that really influence how you kind of wrote the book?
Well, very much, because for a long time, I was really determined to have this be absolutely Rachel's story and have it focused on Rachel Field and her life. And I gave a lot of talks. As I said, I became, a Rachel Field scholar, if you will. And there are people, around the coast of Maine, there's a lot of people who still are big into Rachel Field. There's, books set in this region that people feel very proud of Rachel Field and the legacy. And so I had done many, many talks. And the thing that everyone always got excited about was when I started talking about sharing her house and the parallels between her life and mine that were so compelling. But I really resisted bringing myself into her story. I didn't even want to use the first person when I wrote it at all. And I struggled with that for years until finally I got this idea at a writing conference. I got a prompt that said, write a letter to someone who will never see it. Will never receive the letter. First thing that came to my mind, I started writing to Rachel Field. And it was just like a torrent coming out of me. And I thought, oh my gosh, this might be the way I can do this. So then I had this new vehicle to tell a whole different part of this story, like the side story, which was how Rachel changed my life and changed my writing career. And I wrote letters from me to Rachel that precede each chapter without inserting myself into the biography part. That still is told like a, third person narrator telling the biography story. But the letters are all, you know, my voice saying, you know, hi, Rachel, this is Robin, you know. And so that way it's kind of two different stories woven together. That seemed to make it more sellable. I couldn't sell it to a lot of publishers because they said no one's heard of Rachel Field anymore. And but once I think once I had this other level of contemporary interest, and I think that added a layer of interest to the whole story. And She Writes Press said that we like it happily, and they've been wonderful, and here I am.
Let's talk about working with She Writes Press. I've actually spoken to a number of writers who use their services. How did you first meet them, and what did they bring to the table?
Well, I met them through another Maine writer who I knew of, who had published through them. And then, you know, then I got pretty serious about getting to know them once they said, we want to publish your book. And I've been so, so impressed. I was a little hesitant because, as I said, I am not the queen of organization, and I was worried about having a lot more responsibility for the publishing and marketing and a lot of other stuff to do with the book, which, so in She Writes, it's a little bit more of a collaboration. But the support is phenomenal. They connect you with this amazing network of other women who are hugely supportive and encouraging and so helpful with information and experience. And the whole process has been quite wonderful. And I think it's been a lot more congenial than I think in traditional publishing, you may be a little more lonely.
Now, you talked about how some people were a little discouraging of it, saying that no one's heard of Rachel Field. Did that discourage you? Did you ever think, you know what, why am I doing this? No one's going to care. No one even knows who this person is.
I didn't really. I kind of knew that to some degree, but I was on a mission. I mean, I really felt like, and over time, because of all these odd things, see, I got to back up a little bit. Rachel Field and I were driven by two major callings in our life. She wanted to write all her life, and as did I. When I was 8, if you'd said, what do you want to be when you grow up? I would have said a writer. And I didn't really, I've always written, but it was always the sideline, and I was, the motherhood thing really took over. Rachel Field was desperate to be a mom for years and years and struggled with infertility, got married super late and couldn't have a child, but she finally adopted a child. And, you know, so tragically, her adopted daughter was only 2 when she died very suddenly out of nowhere. So she absolutely was totally fulfilled in all the dreams of her life. She had motherhood on top of the writing, but the motherhood part got cut short for her. And in a way, I feel like I always felt like I loved motherhood. It was my favorite career that I've had, but I longed to also be a writer. And I feel like Rachel Field helped that to be possible. And when I brought children into the field house that she never did get to do, because she never came east once she had her daughter in California, I feel like we kind of brought our two life callings together as a team and supported each other in that way. I don't know, that it's an odd way of looking at it, but it just felt very appropriate. And I knew I had to publish this book. I was prepared to do self-publishing if it came to that, but I happily did not have to deal with that.
Let's talk about marketing. You know, that's obviously a critical part of any kind of book release. You got to sell it, you got to put it out there, got to get it in the media. How do you market this book, especially where the author is still largely so unknown?
Well, a lot of it has been regional, for sure. I mean, she's a lot of people in down east Maine, Acadia National Park region, the coast, there's still pockets of people who are big into Rachel Field. The other odd thing is, because her most famous children's book was about a doll named Hitty, it's called Hitty, Her First 100 Years, there are Hitty doll groups all over the country to this day. And they create their own Hitty dolls, and they were a big pocket of people who continued to be interested in Rachel Field, even during my process. So there were pockets of people who who are definitely still interested. And I tried to market to all those people, but largely Maine. And a friend of mine, another Stone Coast teacher, has been publishing books for 20 years. And she sort of went the old fashioned way. She said, I send out 6,000 postcards with every book. And I there's no way I was going to manage that. But I did get 2,000 postcards with a little lovely design with the cover images and things like that. And I mailed them out, and I had tons of help from a bunch of friends and family who mailed packs of them out to every library in the state of Maine, to all the bookstores in Maine, and to all their friends who the cool thing about Maine is that many, many people come here in the summer. The population of the state, I don't know, something crazy, like it doubles in the summertime. Don't quote me on that, but so many people have this sense of this aura of Maine. It's got this heart home for a lot of people that come from Atlanta and Texas and all over the country. So there's quite a lot of people that were interested in the state of Maine and Maine's history. And so I think it's a bigger market than any. And in fact, you know, even She Writes Press, I don't think expected it to go this well. I'm already on my second printing, and it's going really well.
Congratulations. That's
Thank you.
That's really good. I know that we're looking at the return of things like book expos and conventions and festivals as early as this fall. Are there any that you are looking to go to?
I think the New England Independent Booksellers Association, the NIBA, I guess they call it, I was hoping to get involved with that world, but I haven't looked that far ahead too much because it's so unknown. But I would love to try to get into some of the conferences. You know, some you can just sign up for, some you have to arrange to be invited. And so that's something my publicist has helped me with a little bit, but we haven't. We've been focusing more on the local markets at this point.
Okay. Now, was it hard to be done with this book, given the many years of research and work, and given the fact that you knew that, like, you know, her family, her friends, a lot of folks would be interested in checking it out?
It was incredibly hard to write the end because, as I say, I think one of my delays at the end was that I was reluctant to finish the book because it meant I had to write about her death. So I think I dragged my feet for a long time about that, thinking, oh, I'd have to find some other research things first. But I think what was really holding me back was having to, like, dive so deeply into the tragedy of the end of her life. And I didn't want it to be a tragic book, but that's sort of the end of her life. But from what I'm hearing so far, I think I succeeded in having it feel like an uplifting experience in spite of the tragedy of the end of her life, because she just was a delightful human being and was just brought sunshine into so many people's lives, personally and in her writing. So that was a hard part. Right now, it's such a different world, this marketing part. I have re-immersed in Rachel Field's world in the marketing part, and it's been kind of nice in a way to go back into so much of the earlier part of her life and reacquaint, because I wasn't sure it was going to go. So it's been kind of nice to inhabit her world again so thoroughly in this last few months.
Mm-hmm. Now, have you been able to speak to any of Rachel's relatives or friends and get their feedback on the book?
Yeah, I have. And the Field family was quite renowned. They're from Stockbridge, Massachusetts. There was this one generation that had 12 Field family kids, and a couple of them were Supreme Court justices and, you know, writers of legal code for entire states. And one guy laid the transatlantic cable. Cyrus Field was the first person to lay the transatlantic cable to allow telegraphs across the ocean. So they were this really big deal family. So there's lots and lots of Field family descendants. And they were instrumental in my research. Sadly, one of my great helpers, Russ Carpenter, died before the book came out. But there's another woman who I had access to Rachel Field's medical records at the hospital in LA where she died, only because I got this woman to write me a family permission letter to access her medical. So I definitely got some help from the Field family in that way. And I'm kind of excited about pockets of Field family members coming out of the woodwork as the book starts to get around. And I've had a few of those already, which is kind of fun.
What was it like for you on release day? Because I've heard that some writers, they just are all about it. They'll be like social media posts all day, doing interviews. Others just want to unplug and take a long walk.
My release day was a whirlwind. My big online launch was actually on my release day. But I also took a nap on release day in the afternoon. It started super early. And I had some sort of mundane errands to get done, and I sent out a bunch more, like, it's tonight to tune in with me and Christina Baker Klein online. And I also knew that I had all my four kids and my four in-laws and my granddaughter on their way into town for the weekend coming up. So it was quite a flurry of activity. And the book launch with Christina Baker Klein went so beautifully. She's such a pro. And the Bangor Daily News was a co-host and Left Bank Books in Belfast, Maine. And so I had 220 some people registered to come. And it was just a blast. Christina made it super fun. So that went really well. Okay. And then I had a glass of wine and I went to bed.
I'd probably do the exact same thing. Now, I know that most writers have like 101 ideas for their next project. What's next for you?
I've got 101 ideas.
Good answer. So
I'd say that I'm waiting a little bit to see what bubbles to the top, but I think two of the things. Okay, so I'm going to list a few of them. One is I wrote columns for the Bangor Daily for many years, and they were mostly profiles of people in Maine. And I really enjoy that. I like telling people stories. And I'd love to collect a bunch of those and create a book out of it and maybe fill in some blanks with a bunch of new stories of people around the state of Maine. So that's one thought. I also have a book that I wrote in a year on a very, pretty different subject. It's about end of life and how we deal with the end of life and grief in the United States and issues of, medical assisted dying and all that stuff. And it's all around my experience of the death of my mother. My mother died in 2014 and my father in 2017, and they both chose to die at home by stopping eating and drinking. So it was a powerful experience. And I wrote an article called How Do You Help Your Parents Die that was in Solstice Literary Magazine. And that's still remains a field very near and dear to my heart. I think we can do much better in our country with this very profound and often quite beautiful a chapter of the human experience. And so I would like to go back and revisit this book that I wrote and completed in a year, but I haven't looked at it again since, a couple of years after my mother died. So I'd like to revisit that. And then on the lighter side, I have a lot of poetry, and I'd love to revisit my poetic life. I'm going to a poetry retreat in June, and I find rhyming verse delightful. I love writing it. I love emoting that way. And I think maybe I'll go back and forth between those two projects, depending on my mood. So that's some of the stuff on my mind.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, Robin, thank you so much for joining me. I really appreciate this. And for the folks at home, go to robincliffordwood.com for more information, get your copy of The Field House. And Robin, I'm sure we'll talk again really soon.
Wonderful to meet you, Max, and thank you so much for having me on your show.
This is Angelina Singer, author of the Upper World series, and you're listening to Citywide Blackout, the best podcast for independent artists.
All right, folks, that brings this episode to a close. You can follow the show on Facebook under Citywide Blackout and Twitter and Instagram under Citywide Max. Listen to the show on Podbean, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, TuneIn, Amazon Music, and every Saturday at 10 p.m. on Boston Free Radio. As always, keep those ears open.